Side 4, An Agent in Place, by Robert Little, continuing on page 122.
Remember the great helmsman's campaign to cut down on the consumption of alcohol, he asked, flashing more champagne into both their glasses. At the height of it, two Russians are queuing for vodka. When their turn comes, they discover there is none. One of the Russians complains that the trouble with the great helmsman is he is a teetotaler. The second Russian, Vadim tilted back his head and tossed off another glass of champagne. The second tells his friend, look on the bright side, he might have been celibate.
Don't you get it, Aida?
If he were celibate, we would all have to give up sex. Mind you, contrary to the conventional wisdom, it would not be a catastrophe giving up sex. We would still have our assholes to scratch when we felt the urge for a satisfying physical sensation.
Aida knew from experience that Vadim was only trying to goad her into an argument. For once, she refused to rise to the bait. She felt slightly dizzy, though she didn't think it was because of the champagne. The restaurant atop the tower made one complete revolution every 40 minutes. Khuchkova sprawled below them like a toy city in a museum. She could see Opyekudin's statue of Pushkin and the planetarium in the corner where the Tverskaya, the original name of Gorky Street, turned into Leningrad Prospekt. She could even make out the building at the university on Sparrow Hills, now Lenin Hills, where she had been washing windows when she met Vadim. An image came to her. Thinking that it might one day form the nucleus of a poem, she committed it to memory. The image was of the restaurant sitting perfectly still atop the tower and Khuchkova rotating beneath it like a record on a giant turntable at the rate of one revolution every 40 minutes. The dizziness persisted when Aida stepped out of the elevator after lunch. Glancing at her watch gave her an idea, and she slowly unwound herself in a counterclockwise direction. Closing her eyes, she imagined that she was going back in time to undo the future, to fix things so that things did not need to be fixed. Sure enough, the dizziness passed. The gesture tickled Vadim, who offered to give her a lift in his taxi.
You are dizzy from love, he told her when they had settled in the back seat of the cab he rented by the year. It is the American who is making your head spin.
When Aida failed to respond, Vadim elbowed her in a rib.
Admit it, Aida. I have not seen you like this since you fell for that Polish critic who lisped. You are crazy about the American, but you are playing with fire. Even with all this glasnost crap they bandy about, there is no place for you and your American in Russia. I know you better than you know yourself, Aida. When he leaves, he will invite you to go with him, but you will refuse, even if it breaks your heart. Remember the poem you underlined in red and left on my pillow the day I suggested we emigrate to Paris?
Smiling at Vadim's unerring ability to pierce to the core of a problem, she whispered Akhmatova's lines. I heard a voice call, leave your remote and sinful country, leave Russia behind forever. Nodding, Vadim finished the poem in chorus with her. I covered my ears with my palms. Vadim dropped her off in front of the Kremlin hospital, and she joined the queue winding down the corridor toward the hospital pharmacy. The stench of vomit was overpowering, and Aida pulled the fox fur up over her nose to filter the air she breathed. When her turn finally came, she carefully unfolded her authorization and held it up for the pharmacist to read. Please, his dose is 2.5 milligrams multiplied by his weight. His weight is 30 kilos. Instead of turning back toward the shelves brimming with Western drugs, the pharmacist noted the number on Aida's authorization and started rifling through the green index cards in a cardboard file box. She finally came up with the card she was looking for and pulled it half out of the box. The steel teeth in her mouth flashed malevolently as she looked up and with callous indifference announced, Your authorization for pyrenethol has expired. Aida's heart started hammering against her ribcage. Her knees began to give way, and it took all her concentration to remain on her feet. Such a thing is not within the realm of possibility, she protested. She suddenly realized that she had spoken the words in her head, that they needed to be repeated out loud. Such a thing is not within the realm of possibility, she cried shrilly. But the pharmacist was already peering over her shoulder and calling, Who's next? You obviously do not understand, Aida told the pharmacist in a whisper so controlled, so strained, that her voice did not strike her as familiar. My son must have these pills. It occurred to her that the pharmacist might not have seen the piece of paper that had been folded and unfolded so many times it felt soft to the touch. So she held it up again. I have an authorization. Purinethol, 75 milligrams of 6 mercaptopurine a day, signed with an official seal. The floor under Aida began to wheel, and she clutched the edge of the counter to keep from falling. Had Kuchkova started rotating under her feet, one revolution every 40 minutes like a record on a turntable? Behind the counter, the pharmacist reached for a telephone. Either you make way for the next person, she warned Aida, or I will summon an orderly. Aida backed away from the pharmacy door, walking as if in a dream past the women queuing, past the hall clock that had stopped working many years before, her right hand on the wall to steady herself. She came to a door marked Administration. She pushed through it into an office. 5 women were busily preparing bills with the aid of abacuses. The clatter of the wooden beads broke off abruptly as the women became aware of the intruder, her hair disheveled, the head of her fox piece trailing along the floor. For an instant, Aida thought she was back in the metro, and the fat man who had rubbed her ass was staring at her as if she were mentally deranged. Images of buzzards ripping entrails out of decomposed corpses flashed through her brain. She flailed an arm to ward off a buzzard and shouldered through another door into an inner office where a gray-haired man in a white smock was fitting dentures into the jaw of a skeleton. It occurred to Aida that she had somehow managed to slip across a frontier into a world of madness. I have a written authorization, she cried out, waving her handkerchief's soft scrap of paper as she stumbled toward the man in the white smock. His dose is 2.5 milligrams of 6 mercaptopurine multiplied by his weight, which is 30 kilos. And then Aida was down on her knees, begging in disjointed sentences for medicine, and the man in his white smock was stabbing at an intercom, and 2 young men in white shirts and white trousers and white shoes were pulling her roughly to her feet and propelling her down a corridor and feeding her into a revolving door and then spinning it, expelling her from the building. A blast of icy air brought her back to the terrible reality of who she was and where she was and what had been denied her. Cramps stabbed at her intestines. An elderly woman came up to her and buttoned her coat and wound the fox piece around her neck and put a comforting arm around her waist. When everything else fails, the woman whispered, you must turn to God. God has abandoned Russia, Aida retorted bitterly. The woman did not argue. Do you have someone you can call, she asked, someone who can come and get you? Vadim, Aida muttered to herself. He organized the authorization. He will fix things so I can have another one. Are you all right now? The woman asked anxiously. Can you manage? Yes. Yes, you are very kind. Squeezing Aida's fingers, the woman smiled up at her. There is a God, she whispered. There is also his son. There are also his faithful servants, of whom I am one. The woman disappeared into the hospital. Still feeling shaky, but concentrating on the absolute necessity of finding Vadim, Aida started toward the street. A black Zill limousine was parked at the curb directly in front of the hospital. Aida noticed that both the back door and the front door were open. Men wearing identical belted raincoats stood next to the open doors. Zinaida Ivanovna Zavaskaya, the taller of the two, politely inquired when Aida came within earshot. Yes? The man stepped forward and took a firm grip on her elbow. You are invited to come with us, he said, as he steered her toward the waiting limousine. Taking refuge in a kind of delirium, convinced that Vadim must have rented the limousine by the year, Aida permitted the 2 men to fold her into the back seat. The window shades had been pulled down, the lights turned off, her granny glasses fitted over her eyes, the tape inserted in the video machine. Sitting with unnatural stiffness on a straight-backed wooden kitchen chair directly in front of a television set, Aida stole a glance over her shoulder. The 4 men in the room were staring over her head at the television. She turned back and watched the silent image swim into focus on the screen. Unbelievably, A naked woman could be seen bending over something that looked like an erect penis, caressing it first with her heavy breasts, then drawing it delicately into her mouth. Why were they showing her a pornographic film? The last time she had been arrested, they had been more straightforward in their efforts to humiliate her. One man had lined up her face with his left hand and punched her in the nose with his right. Then they had folded her over like a napkin, torn off her undergarments, kicked her legs apart so that the doctor who had pulled on a surgical glove could insert a finger in her anus. On the television screen, the woman seized the penis with her hand and carefully fitted herself onto it. Aida wondered what it would be like to see herself copulate. The few times she had made love with a woman, she had been able to catch glimpses of herself in a mirror set against the wall next to the bed. She remembered thinking, when she had been making love with the American in Peter, that she would have liked to see a film of it, would have liked to watch the coupling and uncoupling from several points of view. On the television screen, the woman arched her spine, causing a cascade of long hair that seemed vaguely familiar to spill behind her. And then Aida recognized the hair, and the gesture, and the woman. A stifled scream tore from her throat as she wrenched her head to one side. Akhmatova's acid voice reverberated in her brain, repeating three lines over and over as if a needle had been stuck on a record. All has grown confused. I cannot discern who is man and who is beast. The man who seemed to be directing the interrogation nodded at one of his colleagues, who shut off the video machine and the television set and switched on a lamp that played directly into Aida's face. She lifted an arm to shade her eyes and tried to make out the dark figures circling like buzzards around her chair. How did you get such a film? She demanded, and immediately regretted it. What did it matter how they had gotten it? She tried to stop her hands, her knees, from trembling, but could not locate the muscles that controlled them. She tried to regulate her breathing, but even that was difficult. What air she took in came in little sucking gasps. She had been infected with fear by her father. She was permanently frightened. A hand materialized out of the darkness to offer her something. It will not bite you, a sarcastic voice said when she hesitated. Take it. Aida felt something almost weightless being placed in her palm. Squinting, she held it up to the light. It was a small brown paper satchel with a gummed label that read, Purinethol, 75 milligrams of 6 mercaptopurine, to be taken orally at supper each day. Her fingers locked around the satchel and she clasped it to her breast. The hand appeared out of the darkness again to pry her fingers from the satchel and remove it. Several minutes passed before Aida could find a voice. Her lips, her mouth, were bone dry. What game are you playing with me? She whispered huskily. Her head was reeling with possibilities. They wanted to have sex with her in return for Sava's weekly ration of purinethol. They wanted her to denounce someone as an enemy of the people. They wanted her to stop writing seditious feminist poetry. How long have you been sleeping with the American Bassett? Someone inquired from the shadows. The question propelled Aida across another frontier. She suddenly found herself in the wintry world of her father's nightmares, where you are beyond fear because the thing you are most afraid of has happened. It dawned on her that she was being tested by what she called her muse and others referred to as God. With this realization, her hands, her knees, ceased trembling, and she recognized as her own the voice she summoned to respond to the insolent question of the interrogator. So, times have not changed that much after all, she said, articulating each word. You want me to give him up in exchange for the pills. We do not want you to give him up. We want you to continue to see him. We want you to continue to make love to him, a second man added. We want you to go on sucking his cock, a bored voice remarked. Aida retorted with a sneer. Only someone from a Gestapo could make a natural act of sex sound vulgar. Everyone who has seen the film agrees, the same bored voice commented. You fuck like an animal. Aida, wounded, cried out, Everyone who has seen the film! It is in great demand at the office, the bored voice explained. The object of intercourse, Aida moaned, is intimacy, not entertainment. Either you want the pills, or you do not want the pills, snapped the man directing the interrogation. I want them, Aida said tiredly, but I cannot, I will not lie to the American. Two of the shadowy figures retreated to a corner of the room and conversed in undertones. Aida heard one of them snicker. She asked, Can you turn this light off? No one bothered to reply. The man directing the interrogation strolled back and circled Aida's chair. His voice came out of the darkness from different directions, making Aida feel as if she were still in the rotating restaurant. We do not ask you to lie to him, he explained. We want you to tell him the truth. Tell him about the pills. Tell him about the film. Tell him about us. Someone pressed a 2-day supply of pyrenithol into Aida's hand. You have 48 hours to bring us what we want. Chapter 15. Ben felt a storm raging in the lobe of his brain that produced emotions. His toes, his fingertips actually tingled. The pulse drumming in his ears almost drowned out the wild words spilling from her mouth. Almost, but not quite. They were standing in an overheated room in the Pushkin Museum, but her lips were as blue as the day she had sucked the sliver of ice in front of the revolving door of the Druzhba Cafe. He explored her face for some sign of how she was taking it. She was taking it as if it were the end of a world. So, the KGB had been watching him after all. He had assumed that if the Russians got wind of the love affair, he would be the one to be blackmailed. It had never occurred to Ben that they would try to get at him through her, get at her through her son. She ran out of words and sighed and turned away from a window and stared so intently at an enormous Bonar still life that Ben suspected her of committing it to memory, as if once memorized she could seek refuge in it. Ben broke the spell with a question. Why does Sava need medicine? There was a fruit orchard in the Bonar. Aida reached out to brush her fingertips against the trees. A matron, in a shapeless brown sack of a dress that buttoned down the front, called sternly from across the room, It is not permitted to touch the paintings! Aida's hand drifted back to her side. He has acute lymphoblastic leukemia, she said dully. Her throat was bone dry and aching. Remission was induced by an American drug named pyrenithol, which blocks the multiplication of white blood cells. That is what leukemia is, the proliferation of abnormal white blood cells. She noticed a splash of bright red on a Matisse canvas across the room. With sudden intensity, she whispered, Akhmatova says somewhere that only blood smells of blood. How can you think of poetry at a time like this? When the world was stark raving mad, a handful of poems saved Akhmatova. It is what can save us, dear heart. His thoughts racing ahead, he breathed in deeply and breathed out deeply and said, After what has happened, is there still in us to save? And waited for an answer. He discovered to his surprise, he was afraid to hear. I do not blame you for what has happened, Benedict. I do not love you less because of it. Oh, God, he muttered. He was suddenly struck by the staleness of the air in the room. He glanced at the window, longing to throw it open, to feel the blast of cold air sweep through the museum. He looked quickly at the matron, thought he heard her stern warning in his ear, It is not permitted to touch the windows either. He was not sure if she had actually spoken, or he had imagined it. He looked around, tensely. 4 French tourists were studying a vuillard near the entrance of the room. A teacher was lecturing to a group of teenagers gathered around a statue in the adjoining room. Ben steered Aida over to the next painting, another Matisse alive with colors and textures. I could get you the pills, he whispered. She shook her head. I thought of that, but it won't work. They said if you do not give them what they want, they will cancel my Kuchkova residence permit and pack Sava and me off to some remote village in Central Asia where you cannot even buy aspirin. They will find an excuse to expel you from the country. The white blood cells will proliferate and Sava will die. Ben kneaded his lower lip with his teeth, thinking hard. You said they showed you a film. What kind of film? When she failed to respond, he shook her elbow. What was on the film? Us. In Peter. In the hotel room. He wondered how they had done it without his noticing. probably by shifting the point agent, trailing him from in front, planting microphones, listening to conversations, getting wind of their plans in time to install cameras behind two-way mirrors. Of us, in the hotel room? We were engaged in an act of sex, in a sex act. We were making wonderful love. Ben remembered the act of sex, the sense of miracle with which it had been suffused. He remembered every time they had made love, could close his eyes and reconstruct each sex act in his brain, could feel the cool curve of her skin beneath his palm. Shaking away the vision, he asked, "What about Vadim? He got you the original authorization. You told me he had connections. Maybe he can get you the pills." "I was with Vadim when I left the message for you at the embassy. He made several phone calls, but his sources have all dried up. He said he thought I was in over my head." "Maybe they're bluffing. Maybe if we sit tight, 40 hours from now, I will have no more pills to give to Sava." The group of teenagers filed into the room and formed a half circle around the bonar. Ben took hold of the sleeve of Aida's coat and pulled her into the next room. "Tell me again what they want." "So, they said something about seven dwarfs. They said you would know what that meant. They said something about wanting an itinerary." Ben stared at the Matisse in front of his face. Details leapt from the painting, shades of color, brush strokes that trailed off to nothing, the thickness of the paint, its texture. It seemed to him he had never looked at a painting in his life as he was looking at this one. He felt as if he were participating in its creation, as if the paint were still wet. Turning back to Aida, talking in a whisper, he started to unravel the mystery of who he was for her. "I work for the Arms Control Inspection Team. They are the ones who go around the country inspecting factories and military bases and missile sites to make sure the Russians live up to the disarmament agreements they sign. Inside the embassy, they are called the Seven Dwarfs. I keep records and submit expense accounts and run errands for them. I don't have access to secrets. Could you get your hands on an itinerary?" After a moment, Ben nodded. "What would the KGB do with it?" "The whole logic of on-site inspection depends on the Russians not having advance notice of which sites will be inspected."
"You mean the Russians could cheat?"
When Ben nodded again, Aida covered her eyes with a hand. "Sava is condemned if we do not give in to them, and we are condemned if we do."
"Why do you say we are condemned?"
"The day we met, I told you violence was a circle. Oh, Benedict, don't you see it? We will duck for as long as such a thing is possible, then we will begin to wound each other."
For an instant, Ben almost regretted going back on his "I hope to Christ I never see you again."
"Look," he said, "I'll find something inconsequential for you to pass on to them. It will buy us time. There has to be a way out. Maybe when they see how low on the diplomatic ladder I am, they will back off rather than risk an international incident." Even as he tried to reassure her, she spotted in his eyes something that made her shiver, a fiery lucidity, a feverish shrewdness, almost as if he had expected this to happen, almost as if he were scheming. From a long intimacy with fear, she understood that he was not frightened. It was his lack of fear that terrified her more than anything else. It had been a white night for Manny Custer. Making his rounds at the end of the previous workday, he had punched in the door code. The embassy security officer guarded copies of all door codes and safe combinations in his own safe and let himself into the deserted political section on the 8th floor. Looking around for classified documents that might have been left out on desks, he had absently twirled the dial of a safe. To his surprise, the dial had stuck and the heavy door had clicked open. The assistant political attaché who had locked it for the day had forgotten to give the dial an extra twirl. Manny had posted a Marine next to the open safe and had summoned the assistant political attaché back from a cocktail party in the Hotel Peking. The ambassador and the deputy chief of mission had been notified along with the CIA station chief, Charlie Inkerman. They had all hurried back from a reception for some visiting firemen from the House Armed Services Committee to assess the seriousness of the breach of security.
With Manny, the ambassador, the deputy chief of mission, and Inkerman breathing down his neck, a very miserable assistant political attaché had conducted an inventory of the documents in the safe. Nothing was missing, but as Manny felt obliged to point out, this didn't guarantee that unauthorized eyes hadn't gotten a glimpse or a photograph of some no-forn or Orcon text in the safe. Manny spent several hours filling out and filing a top-secret breach of security report, which concluded that because the safe was in an area of the embassy where access was strictly controlled, the likelihood of an actual penetration was negligible. Manny's assessment did not get the assistant political attaché off the hook. The same night the safe was found unlocked, the ambassador appended a scathing note to his fitness report that more or less ensured that the current tour in Moscow would be his last. "Another career bites the dust," Inkerman commented to Manny when the two met for their daily briefing the next morning. He ran the palm of his hand over his slicked back hair, smoothing it down over the bald spot. "You want my opinion, I think the ambassador would have been just as happy if you had locked the safe yourself and finished your rounds." Manny swallowed a yawn. "The drill is standard operating procedure. You find a safe open, you post a guard, you notify the ambassador, you get the custodian of the safe to do an inventory, you file a breach of security report." Inkerman tapped a lead pencil on his blotter. "You knew from the marine log nobody had been up there." Manny, his hands clasped behind his head, watched the point of Inkerman's pencil drumming on the blotter. Inkerman noticed him watching and stopped. Manny said, "The object isn't to screw some dumb assistant political attaché. The object is to make sure it doesn't happen again. In 10 days, every diplomat in every embassy around the globe will have heard about the ruined career and started spinning the dials of their safes to make sure they're locked." He shrugged again. "Whatever." The station chief reached into his in-basket and let the folds of teletype paper slide through his thick fingers. He came to the item he was looking for. "Your sand's running out, Manny. Your replacement's due in sometime next week. You'll overlap him a month to show him the ropes. Then we'll throw a bash for you at the Praga restaurant and give you a wristwatch with an inscription citing your long and distinguished career and drive you to the airport. Have you thought about how you're going to spend your retirement?" A gleam appeared in Manny's eyes. "Maybe I'll read books. Maybe I'll write them. You'd never know we were on the same side all these years. Were we?" Inkerman shook his head in disgust. Manny uncoiled in the chair. "I've been meaning to ask you something." The station chief stuck a plastic cigarette between his lips and began to gnaw on the end of it. "Ask quick. I have a 9:30 due any minute." "It's about Benedict Bassett." "Yeah, so?" "It's about him working out of your ribbon room. You'll dirty your ear keeping it to the ground one of these days. You got to admit it's curious. The housekeeper who locks himself more or less regularly in your ribbon room. So what does he do?" Inkerman was beginning to enjoy the conversation. "For all I know, he masturbates over pictures he stores in his safe." Manny didn't laugh. "Bassett claims he is enciphering status reports for the Seven Dwarfs using ciphers he keeps in the safe you gave him. But I don't think that's it." "Why not?" "I checked the outgoing log in the communications bubble. Bassett does turn up with an enciphered message from the dwarfs from time to time, but it would hardly take him..." Manny pulled an envelope from his breast pocket and looked at some notes he had jotted on the back of it. 9.5 hours, which is how much time he spent up here last week, for example, to encipher the 5 messages he sent. "Maybe he is a slow worker," Inkerman suggested. "Maybe what he's really doing is working for the company," Manny said. "He's not company," Inkerman said flatly. "Then again, maybe he's working for you, and you're freelancing." Inkerman stood up to indicate the meeting had come to an end. "Like I said, your replacement will need a 4-week overlap, after which you will be on your way stateside. You should consider this formal notification of an impending transfer of responsibilities and prepare the appropriate paperwork." Heading for the door, Manny said, "Thanks for your help." "Anytime," Inkerman called after him. He couldn't contain a snicker as he added, "Only ask if I can do something for you." "Whatever," Manny muttered before the door slammed. The last time Manny's nose had been a twitch, He had caught one Marine covering for another who should have been on duty, but as things turned out, was being dined and wined and sexually ensnared by a luscious Russian swallow. The discovery had led to the foiling of a Soviet operation to penetrate the embassy. Waiting now near the mailboxes inside the main entrance of the embassy, Manny felt his nose a-twitch again. It was true that he spent most of his waking hours treating possibilities as probabilities, true that he spent most of his non-waking hours converting probabilities into nightmares. But what embassy security officer didn't? Imagining that every case was the worst case was an occupational disease. He reminded himself that he had only another month or so to go before whatever happened would happen on someone else's watch. The thought gave cold comfort to an old pro like Custer. At 6:20, he caught a glimpse of Benedict Bassett hurrying through the courtyard behind the embassy and handing his burn bag to the wiry technician who tended the incinerator. Moments later, Bassett waved to the Marine on duty at the checkpoint on his way out of the front door of the embassy. Manny quickly pulled on his knee-length ski parka and ambled after him. He caught up with Bassett in the street.
"Well, Mr. Bassett, looks as if we punched the same clock for once. Where are you off to?"
Ben seemed rattled.
"I was going to walk over to the Metropole and grab a drink at the hard currency bar before heading home. Mind if I keep you company part of the way?"
Without waiting for an answer, Manny fell into step alongside Bassett.
"I'm heading down Gorky to a gastronome I know not far from Red Square. They sell pickled herrings from the Baltic that remind me of my wife's herrings. She used to pickle them herself. I lost the recipe when she died."
Their heads hunched forward, their hands plunged into their coat pockets. Manny and Bassett trudged past a peasant woman in a thick quilted army coat peddling clumps of parsley.
"They're an amazing people, these Russians," Manny was saying in a lazy drawl. "A czar like Peter the Great could build a city like Leningrad to open a window to the west and then murder his son. A czarina like Catherine the Great could flirt with 18th-century French liberalism and then murder her husband."
"They say there are two sides to Russia," Ben remarked. "Everything is exactly as it seems, but the opposite is also true. Voznensky wrote a poem on the subject called Anti-Worlds." He glanced sideways at the security chief. "You obviously like the Russians, or you wouldn't have bothered to learn their history."
"I like them, but I don't trust them, Mr. Bassett. I will break bread with them and let them divide the loaf in two, but as the peasants say, I want to have first pick."
Manny shrugged.
"Whatever."
They came abreast of a fishing supply store. "Are you an angler, Mr. Bassett?"
"An angler?
A fisherman?"
He steered Ben over to the window. "Come on, let's window shop for a minute. The Russians make some fine lightweight casting rods. If you go out into the countryside, you can pick up some homemade flies that will knock your eye out." Manny seemed genuinely interested in some of the rods and reels in the window, pointing out which ones were for rivers and which for surf. When they started down Gorky again, Manny said, "It was right after the Bolshevik Revolution that Lenin posed the question, 'What should you give starving people, fish or fishing rods?' Do you have an opinion, Mr. Bassett?"
"Both."
Manny had to laugh. "You're avoiding having to make a choice."
"I suppose I am."
They came to the gastronome, which had a long line winding out the door and down the sidewalk.
"Here's where our paths part," Manny said. "Thanks for your company."
"You did most of the talking."
Manny smiled thinly. "And you did the right amount of listening." Ben, trying to hide his relief that Custer was not going to tag along with him any further, strode off down Gorky and soon disappeared in the crowd. Manny watched him go, then ambled away from the queue and headed for the nearest metro to return to his apartment in the complex across from the Hotel Ukraine on Kutuzovsky Prospect. Tinkling the usual rocks against the sides of a tall glass containing double the usual scotch, Manny stared out the window at what he could see of the city. Below, droves of dark figures bundled in layers of clothing were cutting across the dirty snow of Kutuzovsky Prospect, which was laced with the tracks of tires. A dirty yellow motorcycle with a dirty yellow sidecar attached to it made its noisy way up the street, backfiring every few meters. On the other side of the wide boulevard, long lines of shoppers snaked back and forth across the sawdust-covered floors of brightly lit stores, which Manny knew had next to nothing piled on the thick glass shelves.
Manny's eyes focused on his own reflection in the window, and he caught sight of the grim smile of satisfaction playing on his lips. It was true what they said about him collecting details the way other men collected lint in their trouser cuffs when trousers still had cuffs. Item. Walking away from the embassy with Bassett, Manny had observed out of the corner of his eye the peasant woman in the thick quilted army coat selling parsley. He had seen her raise a bouquet of parsley as they passed, had seen a young woman carrying an airline bag detach herself from the queue and fall into step 20 paces behind them, had seen her turn a shade too quickly to window shop in a store selling used spare parts for automobiles when he and Bassett stopped in front of the store selling fishing rods. She had probably noticed Manny glancing nonchalantly over his shoulder, had probably realized that she did not look like someone who would be window shopping for used spare automobile parts, because she had removed her fur hat and lowered the ear flaps and replaced the hat on her head. Moments later, she had peeled off down a side street as a dirty brown sedan pulled over to the curb across Gorky. A tall man wearing an overcoat with a fur collar had gotten out. He had strolled down Gorky parallel to them for a time. Then he, too, had peeled off to be replaced, if Manny's instinct was accurate, by a young couple with their arms around each other's waists. Manny, who had organized his share of surveillance operations during his back-to-back tours in Turkey, recognized professionals at work when he saw them. Either he or Bassett was being followed by some very experienced folks who were going to a lot of trouble and expense to keep the surveillance from being noticed. Item. Heading for home, Manny had doubled back on the metro line, had lingered inside the station near Kutuzovsky Prospect, had entered a liquor store near the Hotel Ukraine, and had ducked out of a back door and circled around through an alley to the street to see who might be waiting for him. No one had been waiting for him, which meant that it was Bassett and not Manny who was being followed. Item. Wandering through the embassy's new office building earlier that week, Manny had come across a package on the floor outside the post office from Stockman's department store in Helsinki addressed to Benedict Bassett. Checking the master invoice posted on the bulletin board, Manny discovered that Bassett had ordered a fleece-lined denim jacket. What was intriguing was the size. 11. Item. During a routine check of the embassy's telephone logs, Manny had noticed a message for Bassett. Please, can he meet Z in front of Pushkin Museum at 4, the message had read. Just Z? Manny had asked the operator who took the message. If she had left a name, I would have recorded a name, the operator had retorted in annoyance. She? Manny had asked. She, the operator had confirmed. Was this female Z American? Manny had inquired with exaggerated politeness. Not sure, the operator had replied. She spoke very slowly, and her English was very precise. To tell the truth, I couldn't tell if she had an accent. Manny had read out the message in the log. Please, can he meet Z in front of Pushkin Museum at 4? Are you sure she didn't say the Pushkin Museum? If she had said the Pushkin Museum, I would have written the Pushkin Museum, the operator had answered testily. Item. Manny was no grammarian, but he understood enough Russian to know that there were no articles in the language, and he had noticed that Russians speaking in English tended to drop the definite article to say, for instance, Pushkin Museum, and not the Pushkin Museum, which meant that if the operator had really recorded the message word for word, the chances were that the Z who wanted to meet Bassett was a Russian woman speaking English. Manny coughed up one of his guttural laughs that had no trace of mirth. It turned into a dry, hacking cough. He had had a department physical before being posted to Moscow. A foreign service doctor had scared him into giving up cigarettes after having smoked 2 packs a day for 35 years. Gradually, the coughing subsided. The doctor, Manny remembered, had tried to get him to give up alcohol, too. He was glad he had resisted. Nursing the double scotch, staring into the accumulating darkness, Manny began to sketch the outline of a theory that would account for the various specks of lint in his trouser cuff. The result was too crazy to be convincing. Then he remembered a shrewd observation he had come across in a book the previous summer. It had been made by the physicist Niels Bohr to a young colleague, Your theory is crazy, Boar had said, but not crazy enough. Chapter 16. During his lunch break the next day, Ben hurried over to the Praga restaurant for a buffet in honor of one of the seven dwarfs being reassigned to Washington. "Can't say I'm sorry to be passing the baton," the dwarf, a marine captain, cheerfully told his replacement, a Navy lieutenant commander named Pierce, whom Ben had picked up at the airport the previous week. "How long were you stationed here?" the lieutenant commander asked. 18 months, 2 weeks, and 4 days, which is 18 months, 2 weeks, and 4 days too long." The other dwarfs and their wives nodded grimly in agreement. The marine captain's wife plucked a wedge of toast covered with salmon from a tarnished silver tray carried by a passing waiter. "Whatever else you do," she advised the wife of the lieutenant commander, "do not set foot in one of their hairdressing emporiums, unless, of course, you want to wind up with hair like this." She threaded her fingers through her bleached silver curls, which were stiff and weathered. Their permanents tend to be really permanent. The ambassador, working on his fourth vodka, beckoned to Ben. "If you give me the watch, I'll put our friend out of his misery," he told him in an undertone. Ben handed him the gift-wrapped package he had had flown in from Stockman's. The ambassador clanked a knife against the side of a vodka bottle. "Ladies, gentlemen, if rank has its privileges, surely one of them is that I get to deliver the official thank you and Godspeed to our colleagues heading for sunnier climes." He turned to address the departing Marine directly. "Captain, you have performed a tedious assignment with competence and perseverance. You have been an adroit referee at our Little League baseball games. You have been a congenial companion at Sam's happy hours. But the thing for which you will be most remembered is that you took all comers to the cleaners at the regular Thursday night poker game." Manny Custer, who never missed a pour if he could help it, raised his glass to the Marine captain. "To paraphrase Winston Churchill," he muttered in a voice that originated at the back of his throat, "never before have so many owed so much to one man. Whatever." The dwarfs and their guests laughed amiably. The ambassador, pulling a face because he had been upstaged, offered the gift-wrapped package to the departing officer. "Something tells me it's a wristwatch," the Marine captain announced as he tore off the wrapping. He opened the box and pulled out a stainless steel Rolex and held it aloft. Everyone applauded. "Read the inscription," the ambassador's wife called. The captain held the back of the watch up to the light. "To RMW from his friends in Moscow." Everyone applauded again. The Marine captain took off his own watch and strapped on the Rolex. "Well, now I want you all to know how much Helen and I..." On the fringe of the crowd, Ben glanced at his own watch, then quickly left the reception. He raced down the steps to the cloakroom and handed his stub to the woman behind the counter. She came back a moment later with his hat and sheepskin overcoat. Getting into his coat, he brushed against a woman with a broken, badly set nose, alive with freckles. Her enormous eyes were dark with fear. She clutched a bright-fringed Uzbek shawl that was draped over the shoulders of her coat. "Excuse me," Ben said very softly. The woman smiled nervously as he backed away from her. When he had disappeared through the restaurant's front door, Aida felt around in the folds of the shawl and found the sealed envelope he had slipped there. She dropped it into her handbag and hurried out of the building into the street. Half an hour later, she pushed through a door into a pre-war apartment building on the Lenin Hills. Stopping at each stairwell to make sure she was not being followed, she climbed to the sixth floor, where it was possible to cross into another wing of the building, then descended a staircase that reeked of urine to the third floor, and rang the plastic bell next to the door with the number 310 on it. The door opened almost instantly, as if she had been expected. A pear-faced young man with tobacco-stained teeth, wearing an overcoat and a thick-knit scarf wound around his thin neck, pulled her inside the apartment and pushed the door closed behind her. "You have the material?" he demanded. Aida noticed immediately that the room was unheated. It was lit by a single bulb dangling from the ceiling. There was a large mirror on a wall next to a closed double door and a television set in a corner, the one on which she had been shown the film clips of her making love to Benedict. Near a kitchenette, there was a wooden table covered with squares of formica, along with half a dozen wooden kitchen chairs, no two of them alike. A kettle at full boil was whistling on the stove in the kitchenette.
Do you have the pills? Aida asked. The man produced a small brown paper satchel from his jacket pocket. Staring at it, Aida backed toward the door. Don't be a fool, the man told her, as if he had been reading her mind, as if he had recognized in her wild eyes the beady stare of a bird about to take to the wing. Aida pulled Ben's envelope from her pocket, but could not bring herself to give it to him, could not bring herself to cross the threshold. The man solved the dilemma by stepping forward and snatching it out of her fingers. He weighed the envelope in his palm, then slit it open with a fingertip and extracted a single sheet of paper, which he proceeded to read. Apparently satisfied, he tossed her the paper satchel filled with the pills. Her fingers working frantically, Aida opened it and counted them. Pulling the shawl tighter around her shoulders as if it were some sort of armor, she reached for the doorknob. Your son will run out of pills Wednesday night, the man warned her. Return here between 3 and 4 in the afternoon 2 days before, and do not speak of this to anyone. Aida turned back. She was a head taller than the man with the tobacco-stained teeth, and for an instant she imagined herself crowding him against a wall and pounding his head into it. The image faded, and she said, Will you give me more pills? We will tell you what we want in return for more pills, the man informed her. The sheepskin collar of his soul warmer turned up around his neck, the flaps of his astrakhan spilling over his ears. Victor pushed through the double doors into the room moments after Aida had left. Captain Krostin appeared behind Victor and started to prepare a pot of tea. Frolov handed Victor the sheet of paper that he had plucked out of Aida's fingers. Nodding, Victor read it, then reached out to shake Frolov's hand. I watched the whole thing through the mirror, he told him. You worked the Zavaskaya woman beautifully. What the American gave us, of course, is worthless, Frolov said. That was to be expected, Krostin called from the kitchenette. His idea of an itinerary, Frolov remarked, is a list of regions they planned to visit, without dates. Krostin lined up 3 kitchen tumblers and spooned a lump of store-bought confiture into each. How does the colonel take his tea? He asked Victor. Dirty, like dishwater, Victor replied. Frolov, normally very reserved, actually cracked a smile. The important thing, Victor continued, putting an arm over Frolov's shoulder, drawing him toward the table, is that he gave us the list instead of going to the security officer Custer. Krostin rinsed the teapot with boiling water to warm it, then spilled out the water, added 4 teaspoons of tea, and filled the pot with the rest of the boiling water. They talked shop for several minutes. There were bills to be paid out of contingency funds, surveillance teams to be rotated into and out of Moscow, a report to be drafted for the old general. What a stroke of good fortune it was, the boy having leukemia and needing those pills, Krostin commented. Victor sank tiredly into a seat at the table and produced a package of dry biscuits from his overcoat pocket. He passed a couple of biscuits to both of his young section chiefs. Krostin half-filled the 3 glasses with muddy tea. Victor said something about having been joking when he said he took his tea dirty like dishwater. He stirred the tea until the confiture dissolved, then gripping his glass at the rim, brought it to his mouth and noisily sipped it. Krostin watched him anxiously. Victor took another sip. I seriously believe this is the worst glass of tea of my life, he said. A shadow of a smile played on Victor's face as he made the announcement. The head of the KGB's 2nd Chief Directorate did not look as if he were suffering. Chapter 17. They met briefly the following afternoon in a stuffy cafe on the Arbat, crowded with workers from a nearby canning factory, but spent most of their 20 minutes together looking over each other's shoulders. Now that they knew they had been followed, it seemed as if everyone who took an interest in them, as well as those who didn't, was a KGB agent. Huddling over 2 cups of watery coffee set on a tiny round table, Ben memorized the fear glistening in Aida's eyes as she told him what had happened in the apartment that she referred to as Gehenna, and he called a safe house. She had recognized the voice of the man who had opened the door. He was the one who had sneered in a bored voice, "You fuck like an animal," the first time she had been brought there. Yes, he had appeared satisfied with the information Ben had provided. Yes, he had given her enough pills to see Sava through Wednesday night. Yes, he would supply more pills, but only when she supplied more information. Dear heart, she groaned. Where will this end? And what will become of us if I oblige you to betray your country? He had no answers to offer her, either in the cafe that afternoon or later in the week when they spent the night together. Vadim was taking care of Sava and Aida's father in an apartment of a friend of Aida's who had gone off to Sochi. Aida, looking drained, looking older, went through the motions of frying some liver that Ben had bought in the diplomatic gastronome. She had set aside two portions for her father and Sava. But when it came time to eat, she discovered that she had lost her appetite for the food on her plate, for the physical assault on the sacred line that Akhmatova said could not be crossed, for life in general. "So, it is difficult for me to believe this is really happening," Aida told him. She was lying in his arms on the bed. Her long, dirty blonde hair was bound in a braid, and both had kept their clothes on, as if they were afraid to expose their naked bodies to some hidden camera. Ben, for his part, seemed alternately moody and optimistic. There were moments when he disappeared so completely into his thoughts that Aida had to repeat his name several times to get his attention. The few times Aida pressed him, he claimed to be hopeful that they would be thrown back like small fish after she had delivered 3 or 4 of his envelopes. The people who were blackmailing them would realize how limited Ben's access to secrets really was and drop the penetration operation. Aida half believed him, half believed it would end the way the nightmares she could never remember ended. With her sitting up abruptly in a cold sweat, surprised and relieved that it had only been a bad dream. The next morning, in a chilly factory auditorium, Aida read some of her poems to several dozen women in blue smocks. 2 days later, she gave another reading to a group of women in white smocks in the operating amphitheater of a suburban clinic. Both readings went badly. Her mind wandering, her fingers drumming against the edge of the lectern, she recited her verses without enthusiasm, forgot lines, started to say something about the origin of a poem, only to lose the thread completely and wind up staring blankly at the audience. The women in the amphitheater shifted uncomfortably in their seats, exchanged looks, whispered among themselves. After the second reading, Aida took the subway across town and delivered a new poem to the editor at Novi Mir, who asked if something was wrong when she agreed, without arguing, to delete the expression menstrual cycle from it. At her apartment that evening, Aida watched Sava doing his history homework on the kitchen table. "Is it so, Aida, that the United States of America's President Truman said America would support whichever side was losing in order to make the Great Patriotic War drag on? That he sent military supplies to us while we were losing but began sending them to the Nazis when we started winning?" Aida, her mind elsewhere, regarded Sava absently. She didn't have the energy to set him straight. "Eat what's on your plate and go to your room," she mumbled. Later, unable to sleep, Aida quietly opened the door of her father's room and looked in. Sava was on his knees next to the wicker chair, arranging the quilted blanket so that it covered his grandfather's old army trousers as he sat, motionless, staring out through the double panes of the window. "What is it you are waiting for all these years, Granddad?" she heard the boy whispering. The old man brought a mutilated hand up to rub the stubble on his chin. He cleared his throat and said, very clearly, "Cossacks." "Cossacks?" When the old man did not reply, Sava, his eyes wide with wonder, asked, "Did you ever see any?" "It's us, the Cossacks."
"Us?"
The old man grunted, "Us." Back in her room, Aida pulled a chair over to the window and settled into it to look out at the street. She saw a man emerge from a building carrying a small dog under his arm. He set it down in the gutter and gently nudged it with his foot until it relieved itself against a tire. She heard the motor of the last bus of the night pass the intersection down the block. She watched a car pull up across the street and leaned her forehead against the cold pane when nobody got out. She could feel the tenseness in her forehead. A migraine must be lurking behind her lid. Finally, a woman emerged from the car and, waving gaily to the driver, darted into the building. The car pulled slowly away from the curb. Aida, relieved, rocked back into the chair. A hollow silence in which the lack of sound seemed to reverberate settled over the deserted street. In the silence, Aida heard a distant voice pose a question. It was only when she formulated an answer that she discovered the conversation was taking place in her head. "Describe your latest arrest." "They did not actually arrest me. There was no tea, no cakes. They sat me in a chair and showed a film of me fucking like an animal." "What conclusion did you reach?" "The object of intercourse is blackmail." "What is in the shortest supply in the motherland?" "Light bulbs, soap, toilet paper, hope." "What is in the greatest supply?" "Dead leaves." "Dead leaves?" "Dead leaves, yes." "I am not sure I follow you." "Do you think it is possible to love a man so much you begin to hate him for complicating your life?" "I am afraid of running out of unshed tears. I am afraid of losing poetry." "You are avoiding the question." "So, I am not avoiding the question. I am avoiding the answer." Going through the motions of housekeeping, Ben showed the ropes to the wife of the new dwarf. He guided Mrs. Pierce through the peeling embassy corridors so she would know where to go for gas coupons or Bolshoi tickets. He arranged with the General Services Office for a maid and a Russian language teacher. He signed her up for the video rental club in the new office building. He took her over to the embassy's warehouse to pick up a toaster and a microwave oven and an electric blanket. All the while, his thoughts raced. He had hoped to meet a Russian woman in Moscow, hoped even to be able to have an affair with her, but he had not been prepared for Aida. Had thought the bitter wounds inflicted by his divorce, the loss of custody of his son, would give him a working immunity on the off chance he came across someone like her. What was it about her that touched a nerve in him, that pulled at him the way Russia itself pulled at him through the thick soles of his shoes? Before he had slept with her, before he had gotten to know the part of her that was bold and bad and gay, he had thought her haunted and hunted. But he saw now that there was more to her than that, much more. Ben was beginning to understand that being a poet in Russia involved more than writing poetry, that the language of her body had everything to do with what she discovered in the spaces between words. The meeting had been jokingly billed as a very mini summit. The case had become important enough so that the old general himself presided. Victor, his toes tingling with gout, sat on one side of the long oak table with his two section chiefs, Frolov and Krostin, downstream. The two senior analysts attached to the general's secretariat faced them across the table. "We operated under the usual ground rules," the junior of the two analysts, a middle-aged woman named Olga Glebova, was explaining to the general. She had a pinched face and bulging eyes and a net of stiff, bleached blonde hair teased up on her head. She spoke with excruciating slowness, as if words were stones set in a stream, and she was fastidiously stepping from one to the other to get across without wetting her feet. "Which is to say, we were not told where the documents came from. We were instructed to evaluate them without reference to origin." Peering through the lower half of octagonal bifocals, Glebova studied her handwritten notes as the general's withered fingers tapped out the passing seconds on the table. Glebova found what she was looking for. "The documents were apparently acquired, as you know and we guess, in four batches. In batch number one, unnamed people in groups of twos or threes are going by train or by plane or by car to various regions of the Soviet Union. They will stay in these regions for periods ranging from 2 to 5 days. By matching this very sketchy information against intercepts from microphones planted in apartments..." Glebova's colleague, the senior analyst N. Filipov, grew impatient and finished the sentence for her. "We were able to establish that batch number one is actually a rough itinerary for the 7 members of the American Arms Control Implementation Unit." The general leaned forward. "But does it tell us anything we did not know before?" Filipov, a stony-faced man wearing a 3-piece pinstriped suit of Hungarian manufacture, one size too tight for his pudgy middle-aged body, shook his head very delicately, as if he were afraid to dislodge his carefully groomed, prematurely gray locks. "Our service has been predicting the itinerary of the American inspection team since they began functioning. Sometimes from things the inspectors said to their wives, sometimes from the clothing or guidebooks they purchased,
Sometimes from the train or plane schedules, the unit's housekeeper was overheard requesting from the travel section on the first floor of the embassy. Filippov arched bushy white eyebrows, which jutted like awnings over his eyes. Take, for instance, the last trip mentioned in the so-called itinerary you gave us. One knew about their intention to visit the ballistic missile sites in the Karakum Desert, since the wife of the inspector in question was overheard telling her husband that Hiva was famous for its hand-woven rugs, and asking if he could bring back several. One also knew that the trip was scheduled for late April, when the wife was overheard during a long-distance telephone call advising her mother-in-law that the last week in April was not a good time for her to visit Moscow. The material identified as batch number 2, Diabova picked up the thread in her plodding, precise style, is made up of disjointed scraps of writing in American English. In places, sentences are fragmented. In other places, even the words are fragmented. From this, we have concluded that the batch represents material recovered at random from an American embassy burn bag. There are two mentions of dwarfs, which means the material almost certainly comes from the embassy's arms control implementation unit, since, as you know, the seven Americans' arms control inspectors are humorously known as the seven dwarfs. Filippov finished the sentence for her. Once again, the material tells one nothing that one did not already know. Details of the office expense account, references to the kind of film and lenses they use when they take pictures on their inspection tours, translations of excerpts of articles on military matters clipped from our journals, a garbled scrap that could be part of a summary of the monthly estimate of our missile readiness. Nothing to set one's heart to quaking here. Batch number 3, Glebova waited on, is the service record of the lieutenant commander who recently replaced the marine captain on the inspection unit. Filippov swallowed a yawn. The general cast a look in Viktor's direction as if to say, "Our two analysts are so excited about the gold mine of information you have come up with, they are having trouble staying awake." The service record of the lieutenant commander, Filippov droned on, duplicates information that our Washington embassy worked up on him when he was named to the Moscow Post. The lieutenant commander comes from a small village in western New York State named Alfred. His biography was published in the local newspaper. "Which brings us to batch number 4," said Glebova. "This batch consists entirely of lists of names of staff members at the American embassy." "I can tell you that this item stumped us for a week," Filippov admitted. "We considered every possibility, that the names were divided according to security clearances, which of course would be interesting to us, that the lists showed who was permitted access to different parts of the embassy compound, that they showed a breakdown of housing assignments, that they represented the duty officer shift for nights and weekends." Across the table, Viktor scraped back his chair loudly enough to indicate he was tiring of the game. Filippov got the message. "The lists," he said, "represent the teams in the embassy's bowling league." The old general, wheezing from a sinus attack, dropped an orange-colored pill into a glass of mineral water and watched it drift to the bottom and dissolve. With a nod from Viktor, his two section chiefs and the two analysts gathered their notes and slipped out of the room. "It is as plain as the nose on your face," the general muttered as soon as the door had closed, "that we can learn more by reading the New York Times." He stirred the bubbling water with the back of a spoon and drank off the discolored liquid in one long gulp. His large Adam's apple worked against the wrinkled skin of his neck as he swallowed. "It seems to me," he went on, settling back into his chair, breathing through his mouth, "that you are running a very big risk for very little compensation. This Bassett is nothing more than a housekeeper without access to important information. If he takes it into his head to go crying to his security people, his lords and masters in Washington will raise hell. We will be caught in the crossfire between the Americans and those of our bosses who have lost the appetite for combating international capitalism. Unless you have some compelling arguments that I have not heard, I am of the opinion that the American should be cut loose and the operation discontinued." Viktor cleared his throat. "Bassett is more than a housekeeper." The general eyed his son-in-law. "What makes you think so?" "We know he had an appointment with the CIA station chief soon after he reported for work at the embassy. We have reason to believe he has been up to the station almost every day since."
Victor reminded the general how the center's microphones had overheard the secretary, Miss Macy, referring to Bassett as our 415 the first time he went up to see Inkerman. How she continued to greet someone she tauntingly called our bashful 415 almost daily. Assuming it was Bassett, what was he doing on the 10th floor, the general asked. I wish we knew, Victor admitted. Our microphones record him in the station's outer office greeting the secretary, Macy. We hear her make a remark about our 415 slumming on the 10th floor, some such thing. We hear a door being opened and closed. He sees Inkerman? The secretary, Macy, always announces Inkerman's visitors over an intercom. Except for Bassett's first visit, she has never announced him. My guess is that he's going into another of the station's rooms. An hour or so later, he can be heard emerging from the room. There is usually more banter. The secretary, Macy, can be overheard hinting she would not mind being invited to dinner or a film. Bassett always begs off. Often it is because he has a rendezvous with the Zavaskaya woman. Victor could see that the old general was torn between his instinct for caution and his instinct to gamble. He turned his chair so that he was facing his father-in-law. We have never before been able to penetrate the embassy's CIA station, he said, masking his excitement behind a facade of professionalism. If we could get our hands on evidence that the CIA is taking advantage of the climate of glasnost to run operations against us, it would strengthen the hand of those of us who think the reforms have weakened the motherland. The general immediately saw what Victor was driving at. Pamyat could profit. Victor nodded carefully. The general's eyes narrowed. What do you propose? We want to turn the screw. We want to put more pressure on the Zavaskaya woman. We want her to put pressure on Bassett. When the ground has been prepared, we will invite him to the safe house for an interview. You want to debrief him? We want to find out what he does during those daily visits to Inkerman's station on the 10th floor. The fingers of the general's left hand slowly curled of their own accord. Victor took the gesture for a summons to gamble. Chapter 18. Squeezed into a corner behind a life-size bronze statue of a nude woman with three eyes and three breasts, Ben reread the lines scrawled on the back of the envelope that Aida had slipped him. Do you think it is possible to love a man so much you begin to hate him for complicating your life? I am afraid of running out of unshed tears. I am afraid of losing poetry. You are avoiding the question. So I am not avoiding the question. I am avoiding the answer. Rising on his toes, peering over the heads of the Muscovites, swirling through the gallery in search of champagne or zakuski or each other, he made out Aida, backed up against a mosaic, a stem of a champagne glass in one hand, a hand-rolled cigarette in the other, surrounded by a gaggle of men whom she kept at arm's length by exhaling bursts of foul-smelling smoke in their faces. She had on the same 1930s pillbox hat with an enormous white feather spiked through it that she had been wearing when he met her under the windows of the rehearsal studio a lifetime ago. Ben needed to be alone with her, to breathe declarations of eternal lust into the nape of her neck, to swear to God that he had not set out to complicate her life. Shouldering through the mob milling around some people's artist's latest oeuvre, a tractor compressed into a package the size of a small trunk, Ben tried to catch Aida's eye, but she turned away without noticing him to hear what her ex-husband was saying. Read the history books and weep, Vadim announced gleefully, waving so wildly with a champagne glass that half its contents spilled onto his corduroy jacket. Karl Marx had pleurisy, bronchitis, carbuncles, asthma, inflamed eyes, a diseased liver, a swollen spleen, migraine headaches, chronic insomnia, chronic diarrhea, ingrown toenails, decaying teeth, and an itching anus probably caused by worms. Freddie Engels had a weakness for wine and women and spent more feeding his horse than Karl earned writing for the New York Herald. And these are the people who gave us communism. Aida drained the last of the champagne from her glass. She was looking around for a place to set it when she spotted Ben. He gestured with his head for her to follow him. Pushing past a sculptor who was ranting drunkenly about how events were moving so rapidly you had to run to be an arrière-garde, she made her way to the cloakroom and collected her blanket-lined overcoat and fox neckpiece. She found Ben waiting on a landing outside the main hall. He started down a corridor ahead of her, opened a door, checked to see if the room was empty, and pulled Aida inside. Kicking the door closed, he pressed her body back against a wall with his own and found her lips in the darkness and kissed her so hungrily and so long that she had to struggle free in order to breathe. They clung to each other for several minutes. Ben finally whispered, "You hate me for complicating your life. I should not have given you the poem. If you don't hate me, why did you avoid the answer? I love you, Benedict. I only wish I had never met you. Aida." There were footsteps in the corridor. Someone could be heard pausing in front of the door. Barely daring to breathe, Aida and Ben held on to each other, listening. The footsteps retreated down the corridor. "Your message frightened me," Ben told her. "How are you?" She remembered how the peasants responded to such a question. "Better than tomorrow," she said with a dry laugh. "Are things that bad?" "Dear heart, I swore to myself I would not tell you, but I must. The last time I delivered your envelope, you only gave me 2/3 of the dose." Ben didn't understand. 2/3 of a dose? "Sava is supposed to take 75 milligrams of 6 mercaptopurine a day. He only gave me enough for 50 milligrams a day." "They made a mistake," Ben said quickly. Even as the words crossed his lips, he knew it had not been a mistake. Slipping out of his arms, Aida moved over to a window, almost opaque with grime, and fumbled in her sack for tobacco and paper, then decided she did not want to smoke after all. Ben came up behind her. "Did you ask him why he gave you 50 milligrams?" She said very quietly, "He wants to see you, Benedict." "Me? He wants to talk to you." After a moment, he asked, "About what?" Aida shrugged. "About the other 25 milligrams. Ben suddenly became aware of the beat of his own heart. He had been wondering when they would get around to him. "He wants to see me about the 25 milligrams? So, he said he was holding out on Sava because you were holding out on him. I gave him whatever I could get my hands on." She shrugged again, but in a particularly apathetic way, as if hiking her shoulders required more energy than she had available. Gripping her fox neck piece, Ben pulled her around so that she was facing him. "I cannot do it," he whispered intently. "There would be no hope of getting out from under if I did. It's one thing if they have films of us making love. It's another if they have a film of me talking to the KGB. Aida nodded grimly. It was the answer she had expected. There was a rush of footsteps in the corridor. A woman could be heard whining, "For God's sake, Leonid, not here." "Where?" a male voice demanded. "Where you like, but not here. What if my husband or your wife saw us leave together?" When the two people outside the door had departed, Aida whispered, "We cannot remain here." Ben thrust an envelope into Aida's fingers. "This is for tomorrow's session in the safe house." He suggested they meet at 5:30 the next afternoon at a workers' canteen on Krasnaya Presnya that they had been to before. "Give me a few minutes' head start," he told her. He checked the corridor, then turned back to plant a quick kiss on her lips before he ducked out of the room. At the canteen the next day, Ben bought 2 coffees and 2 stale donuts and settled at a table in the back. 20 minutes went by without a sign of Aida. Another 20 minutes passed. He fed some kopecks into a payphone outside the canteen's toilet and dialed her apartment. He let the phone ring for several minutes before hanging up. Returning to his apartment, he sat in the dark nursing a tall bourbon and flicking with a remote control device from one television channel to another. On one channel, a member of the Central Committee known for his conservative views was being interviewed outside the Kremlin wall. In the background, the chimes from the Kremlin clock could be heard tolling the hour. "He has opened the door to an orgy of chaos," the Central Committee member was telling the journalist who thrust a microphone in his face. "Only the Communist Party that Lenin created has the force, the experience, the discipline to bring the country back from the brink." The speaker shook his head in disgust. "Our masses will one day wake up to the fact that he is not the patriot he makes himself out to be. I only hope it will not be too late." Ben flicked past two stations running cartoons to another where a team of mobile journalists were interviewing a woman who had gone into the hospital complaining of a urinary infection and had been operated on for appendicitis by mistake. "Our system of socialist medicine has broken down," the woman told the interviewer as the camera zoomed in on the stitches on her abdomen. "All the restructuring in the world is not going to save things. In the old days, someone would have been put up against a wall and shot." "If you were in charge, would you order the execution of the doctor who made the mistake?" the journalist asked. "Absolutely," the woman responded without hesitation. "If we make an example of him, others will do their jobs properly. That's what I say." The remarks came back to Ben several days later as he sat staring at Inkerman's cipher logs in the 10th floor ribbon room. It was true what Manny Custer had said about chaos being right under the surface of the Russia he knew and didn't particularly like. It occurred to Ben that the Russians played with chaos and violence the way someone might toy with a loose tooth in his mouth, working it back and forth with his tongue, taking a certain amount of pleasure from the pain. This attitude explained the gleam of pride in Aida's eyes when she told him, "If you are Russian, you associate happiness with pain. You follow your heart until it breaks." Had she reached the point where her heart had broken? Had she stopped following it? He had not heard from her in the 3 days since she failed to show up at the canteen. He had phoned her apartment a dozen times, had even risked calling from his office, but nobody had answered. He had to know. So much depended on it. After work that night, Ben went through the motions of trying to throw off anyone who might be following him. He mingled with the rush hour crowd in the metro, then at the last instant darted onto a train heading for the last stop. At Rechnoy Vokzal, he lingered inside the station reading tear sheets of Pravda, tacked up on a glassed-in bulletin board until everyone had gone. Emerging from the station, he meandered through a housing project, climbing over rusting gas pipes that honeycombed the ground, coming up behind the shabby building in which Aida lived. The paths in the area were deserted. He circled around to the front of the building, spotted a light in her window on the 5th floor. Entering the lobby, Ben pressed the button lighting stairwell B on his right, but it didn't work. Feeling his way up the narrow steel staircase, he tried to walk softly, but his footsteps seemed to echo through the building. Through his head, too. On the 5th floor, he pushed through a fire door with a round hole where the knob and lock had been. He put his ear to Aida's door and heard the faint notes of what he took to be recorded chamber music. Taking a deep breath, he knocked. After a while, he knocked a second time. He heard footsteps approaching the door. A woman Ben had never seen before opened it and peered out at him. "I am a friend of Aida Zavaskaya," he mumbled in Russian. The woman bellowed, "Aida!" Leaving the door ajar, studying the visitor with undisguised curiosity, she retreated toward her own room. The chamber music broke off abruptly. Aida appeared at the end of a dark, narrow hallway. She did not look as if she were surprised to see him. Ben closed the front door and walked over to her. "I had to come," he told her. "I must know whether you have stopped following your heart." With Ben trailing after her, Aida shuffled into her room. She went over to the door that led to Sava's room, pulled it partly open, and stepped aside. Ben brushed past her and looked in. The room was illuminated by a dim night lamp with a red shade. A poster of a famous Russian rock singer was tacked to the wall over a desk. In the bed that he had shared with Vadim, Sava, twitching in his sleep, lay curled up in a ball. Only an arm and his head were visible above the 2 blankets and the flowery Uzbek shawl that Aida had flung over his thin body. His breathing seemed regular but shallow. For a moment, Ben imagined he was seeing his own son, Felix, curled up in a ball in his bed, his thin body draped with the flowery quilt that had covered Ben's grandfather the day he died. "I took him for his monthly blood test yesterday," Aida whispered. "The results were not good. The blood count, the liver function." Her shoulders heaved in despair. Ben murmured, "Oh, God." Aida closed the door softly. Shuffling across the room, she sank dejectedly onto the edge of the bed. "Sava vomited up his dinner tonight. He is so listless. As if he has no energy. He is paler, too." She appeared to be talking to herself. I must move him into the sun. Ben towered over her. What happened when you gave them the last envelope? The one with the tobacco-stained teeth read what was in it and laughed. He gave me another paper satchel. There were only enough pills in it for 25 milligrams a day. Ben sat down heavily on the bed next to her. Do they still want to see me? Aida shrugged. The answer was obvious. Ben put an arm around her shoulder. Okay, he said. I have lost my way, Aida mumbled. I no longer know what is right and what is wrong in this business. How do you contact them between meetings? I call a number. A man answered. I ask to speak to the man who lost his keys. How many keys? The man asks. I give him a number corresponding to the hour of the rendezvous. He says I must have the wrong party and hangs up. Arrange a meeting for 6 tomorrow night. Are you sure you want to go through with it? Now it was Ben's turn to shrug, as if to say, what choice do I have? Aida let her head settle onto his shoulder. I thank you for this thing you do, Benedict. They sat on the bed, motionless, listening to each other breathing. Ben pushed her gently down on the bed and started to unbutton her blouse, but she turned her head to one side. No, she said dully. Seeing the hurt look on his face, she said softly, Dear heart, to make love, one has to concentrate on not concentrating. You see the problem? Later, after Ben had left, Aida regretted they had not made love. She had been a fool to discourage him. She yearned for the weight of his body on hers. She heard a scraping of knuckles on her bedroom door. Thinking he had come back, she ran over in her bare feet and pulled it open. The woman who shared the apartment was standing there. I forgot to give you your mail, she told Aida. Many thanks, Nadezhda, Aida said, taking the letters. You do not mind I use the kitchen first? The woman asked. My Vladimir had been off to the factory gymnasium lifting weights and was dying of hunger. It makes no difference, Aida said, trying to press the door closed without being too obvious about it. Have I seen him somewhere? The man who came by before, a writer, a painter? He seemed to speak with an accent. He is a friend. Aida put more pressure on the door. By the way, Zinaida Ivanovna, your Sava by mistake used some butter that belonged to me. I would not mention it, except that butter is hard to come by these days. How much did he take? 10 grams, at least. I will pay you back next time I find butter, Aida promised. She pushed on the door and managed to shut it this time. Shuffling through her mail, she added the 2 envelopes that were typewritten to the pile of unopened mail behind the radiator. The 3rd envelope, which had been addressed by hand, she slit open with a fingernail. Inside was a sheet of paper with a crude drawing of a tombstone on it. Under the tombstone was a caption, Your poetry is dirty like your mind. Do everyone a favor. Go get murdered. Crumpling the paper in her fist, sinking to her knees next to the potted mint geranium in the middle of the room, Aida came a hair's breadth away from offering herself the luxury of shedding some of her unshed tears. But she was terrified that if she started to cry, she would never be able to stop. They met in the back of the workers' canteen on Krasnaya Presnya late the following afternoon. Aida was already installed at a table, gazing at some wedges of salami without seeing them when Ben pushed through the crowd at the counter and found her. She searched his face as he pulled over a chair. Do not go to them, she said. She rested a hand on his arm. I will tell them you have changed your mind. I have a plan, he told her. Her face was a mask. She did not dare let herself hope. A plan? I have figured out a way to put an end to their blackmail. Is such a thing possible? I will make them an offer they cannot refuse. Her heart sank. It did not exist, the offer that could not be refused. Trust me, he said. She pushed a piece of paper across the table. On it was scrawled the name of a metro stop, an address, a stairwell letter, an apartment number. So, Gehenna is on the Lenin Hills, Aida hoarsely observed. A bitter smirk deformed the lips Ben had once found so sensual. Who would have dreamed it was so near? Chapter 19. Emerging from the metro station, Ben brushed past a beggar who had one foot in a dirty plaster cast. She was propped up on a pre-Great Patriotic War wooden crutch planted under an armpit, and held in her free hand an empty paint bucket into which passers-by dropped coins or uneaten sandwiches. Suddenly, Ben could hear the half-cough, half-cackle of his grandfather in his ear. In Russia, the old man was warning, the best that passing someone carrying an empty bucket could bring was bad luck. The superstition was so deeply ingrained in Ben's psyche that he was tempted to retrace his steps to take a different way out of the metro. Especially today, he would have liked the omens to be auspicious. He pulled out the scrap of paper with the name of the metro stop, the address, the stairwell letter, the apartment number scrawled on it, got his bearings, started up a hill that led to the university. Halfway up, he came to a pre-Great Patriotic War apartment house. It had been built in a style the Russians had taken to calling Stalin Gothic, which essentially meant massive, elaborate, distinctly pretentious, faintly ridiculous. He found stairwell C, which had recently been given a fresh coat of battleship gray, and smelled it, climbed to the sixth floor, crossed over into another wing of the building, descended a staircase that reeked of urine, and rang a plastic bell next to the door with the number 310 on it. A pear-faced young man with sloping shoulders and tobacco-stained teeth pulled it open. He was wearing an overcoat and had a thick knit scarf wound around a thin neck. "Please, come in," he said pleasantly, as if Ben had turned up for nothing more ominous than a session of root canal. "The apartment is not heated, so you would probably be better off keeping your coat on." There was a wooden kitchen table covered with squares of formica in the middle of the room. Four ordinary straight-backed kitchen chairs were placed around it. A naked electric bulb dangled from the ceiling above the table. The man with the tobacco-stained teeth appeared from a kitchenette carrying two tumblers and a bottle of vodka, which he placed on the table. Looking around, Ben noticed a large mirror on one wall next to a closed double door. Circling the kitchen table, he spotted a television set on another straight-backed chair in a corner of the room. "I suppose the television over there is the one on which you showed the film of her fucking like an animal," he told the man with the tobacco-stained teeth. Ben sat down on one of the straight-backed chairs. "Do you come up here weekends and run it for your friends? Do you jerk each other off while you are watching it?" The skin on the pear-shaped face tightened over the cheekbones, erasing any suggestion of innocence. Repressing his annoyance, the man seated himself on a chair directly across the table from Ben. "I can understand that you are agitated," he said. "I wish to point out that we have no desire to harm you. We can work things out so that your compatriots never become aware." Ben leaned forward. "Tell the truth. When you were watching the film, didn't you imagine yourself making love to her? The answer is written on your face. But you must know that she would never make love with someone like you. Your beady eyes, your sallow complexion, your coarse skin, your bad breath give you away. You are a worm." Frolov kept a tight rein on his emotions. "Perhaps a glass of vodka will calm you," he remarked, reaching for the bottle. Ben intercepted his hand. "I will not drink with you. I will not talk with you either." He gestured with a snap of his head toward the mirror on the wall. "I will only drink with him. I have an offer to make, but I will only make it to him." Frolov was losing control. "You are in no position to dictate." Ben caught the sound of the double door opening behind his back. Smiling insolently, feeling as if he had won the first round, he kept his eyes fixed on the man with the tobacco-stained teeth. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.